This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com.
Philosophy Bites is made in association with the Institute of Philosophy.
A builder should never use a drill while a Philosophy Bites interview is in progress. That sounds like a moral principle. More typical examples of moral principles are do not murder, always keep promises. But Jonathan Dansey doesn't believe in moral principles. He's well known for advocating what's called moral particularism. When we have to decide how to act in a particular situation, there are no moral rules. Instead, we should be alive to the situation's relevant moral features.
Jonathan Dansey, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
It's nice to be here, I hope.
The topic we're going to talk about is moral particularism. I expect quite a few people listening to this will never have heard that term. Could you just give us a clue what that is?
Well, most people think about right and wrong in a certain sort of way, which involves the idea that at the bottom of it all are moral principles, principles of the right and principles of the wrong. And we are familiar with principles of these sorts. It's wrong to kill, it's wrong to steal, it's right to help others, and so on. And they think that if there were no principles of this sort, then there would be no distinction between right and wrong actions. The idea that some actions are right and others wrong would collapse if there were no principles to be found. Now, the particularist thinks that that's a mistake, that the distinction between right and wrong doesn't need the support of moral principles, and that this is just as well, since there aren't any.
That's really unusual, because people talk about being principled. That's just a synonym for being a moral person.
Yeah, it is a synonym, but only because people mistakenly think that this is the way morality works. We do want our politicians to be principled. They're supposed to be principled. But I would much rather that they were sensitive to the distinction between right and wrong. That would be good enough for me.
What about a principle like you shouldn't tell lies? That's the kind of thing that adults tell children, even if they don't always exemplify that principle in their actions. They try and give a general rule that is more or less true in almost every situation. It's better not to tell a lie than it is to lie.
Yeah, well, the way we teach children, the way we bring children into moral practice needn't be anything very directly related to the way in which competent practitioners actually operate or need to operate. Just as when you learn a musical instrument, for instance, you do all sorts of things that you would never dream of doing if you were a professional player. It's almost like you get them into the practice in ways that are simple enough for them to understand, or that given their level of competence they can achieve. But you don't expect them to end with that. That's where you start. It's like Wittgenstein said, you climb the ladder and then you kick it away at the end.
But why would anybody believe you? Why would anybody think that morality isn't a matter of principles?
Well, one question is why morality requires principles when other forms of thought don't. So in aesthetics, for instance, where we're judging the quality of a painting or a piece of music, nobody knows any principles about this and nobody supposes we need any. We just judge the particular case and we can discuss it and argue about it, but principles don't enter into the story. And somehow with morality, it's the other way around. The whole idea has got connected to principles, and we feel that without that, moral judgment will just collapse. Now, if you ask, why should anybody think that? I'm devoid of a reason. You can say this is a historical accretion. The Greeks don't talk about moral principles. The church has probably got something to do with it. One thought is this. The church used to propound or educate people in the morality it preached by teaching them principles. Now, there was a reason to do that. People can understand them. They can be operated. It's not as if, however, a mature moral judgment consists simply in the application of these things, and that's why there was casuistry, but that's a different story.
Let's go back to that disanalogy you drew between aesthetics and ethics. So in aesthetics, people make these judgments. They don't have principles on which they make those judgments yet. In ethics, some people say they do, but you think they don't either. But there could be different situations in the different cases. Why, as Kant seemed to think, shouldn't aesthetic judgments be particular judgments, but ethical judgments based on principles?
One answer to the question is there is no reason. But from my point of view, what I can do, I think, is to refute most suggested principles. So if the supposed necessary principles are all false, then we have two choices. One is give up moral thought because it needs principles and there aren't any. Or give up the idea that moral thought needs principles. It's what I do. So I view myself as defending morality against the absence of principles.
Well, let's go back to that example of don't tell lies. The basic principle is you shouldn't tell lies. Now, there's one way of interpreting that as saying you should never tell lies, and that's relatively easy to find counterexamples to. But there are other ways of interpreting that principle.
Yes, there are. The first way, where, as you put it, we should never tell a lie, that means if an action is a lie, then it's wrong no matter what other features it has. Even if it helps or is necessary to save many, it's just wrong. Now, it's very easy to find counterexamples to that, I think, as everybody admits, more or less. You can respond to that fact in one of two ways. You can complicate the principle, or you can rethink what it says. So it says this. It says that every act that's a lie is the worse for it, even though it may have other features that make it the right thing to do. Now, on that account, a counterexample to this sort of principle is going to be a different sort of beast. It's going to be a case where an action is a lie but is not the worse for it, or even is a lie and is the better for it.
If I've understood you correctly, you're saying there's a way of interpreting the principle, you should not tell lies, to mean something like, if anything's a lie, that always counts against it to some degree, but there might be other things to take in consideration. Now, if you can find a counterexample to that, one way of doing that would be to find something which is a lie, but the fact that it's a lie doesn't count against it.
I think it's sort of most striking if you find one where that it's a lie actually counts in favour of doing it. One such case, it seems to me, at least possible, is lying to a liar. Somebody who is a habitual liar deserves lies. I don't see that what you're doing when you lie to them is to some extent wrong because it's a lie. It seems to me that, as it were, tendency is completely trumped or abolished by the fact that this is absolutely the right way to treat such a person.
Well, what about another example? Could you find anything about torture which could possibly be good?
No, not necessarily. For me, the interesting question is not whether I can see off every potential counterexample in the way that you're inviting me to. You know, maybe I'm going to admit that there are some features that have an invariant relevance in the way that people have supposed that lying had, until you point out that, you know, it might not. Perhaps torturing is one, or torturing an innocent person is one, or torturing an innocent and unwilling person is one, or something. Then you might say, at least that's invariantly wrong-making, or invariably counts against what you're doing. No doubt, if you are killing and eating a five-month-old baby because you're bored by a boring football match, this is certainly wrong, and I can't think how it could possibly not be wrong, in fact, absolutely wrong. But what the defenders of principles have to do is to show that every action that is right or wrong is made wrong by principles. Not just finding a few principles that they can defend is nowhere near that. So I think I'm able to allow that there are some features that have invariant moral relevance. And these things are like the old man of Skye, which I think is a rock that sticks up in the middle of the sea, a firm point in a sea of fluidity. And what those firm points don't do is determine the nature of the whole terrain.
But somebody might argue that's not any more particularism. That's a mixed economy. You've got a bit of particularism and a bit of principalism.
Yeah, but it seems to me that you should have the same conception of rationality across the board. Rationality here is not the operation of principles. It is determining the relevance of features. What we do is determine of some of these features that they are relevant in one way in one case and not in another, or the other way in another. And then we come across one or two that are generally relevant, which we notice. But the rationality of moral thought and judgment does not depend in any way on these fixed points.
How does this play out in terms of moral education? We talked about moral education before, how you might want to tell children lies about principles in order to bring them into the world of morality. But if, as adults, we start to recognise that there are no principles, doesn't that make it a lot easier for people to feel free to make their own subjective judgments about how they ought to behave?
Yeah, I don't think I should let you say that what we say to children is a lie. You have to bring them in from outside, and that involves a certain sort of distortion to help people get on board. Now, if you're teaching somebody, I used to play the double bass, teaching someone the double bass, which I used to do, you're going to start off teaching them to do things that they should very soon stop doing. That's not a lie. When I say do it this way, I don't mean do it this way and this is the way the professionals do it. I mean this is the way to start.
I'm also interested, though, in the question of what it is to be an adult or a mature moral agent here. Is it that we just recognise in our environment things which are right and things which are wrong?
I think sometimes it's like that. Other times you have to work it out. It isn't as if it's always going to be easy. The intuitionists are held to say that you sort of open your moral eyes and the truth floods in without effort. But nobody suggests that this is a skill that's easy to develop, or that once you've got, you never lose, or that enables you to discern without any difficulty, every relevant feature. Let's go back to aesthetics for a minute. The same would be true. You can lose your eye, you can lose your ear, you can lose your moral eye. And if you want to get it back, you might have to listen to others.
The worrying thing is that with aesthetics, some people never get an aesthetic eye, as it were. Some people are incapable of discerning qualities in works of art that other critics can see immediately. Now, if that's the case with morality, that's a lot more serious, because all of us have to be in the moral world, even if we don't have to be in the aesthetic.
Yes, that is true. One thing is that people mind a lot more about morality in many cases, so they're sort of constantly telling you off. That does keep you on the straight and narrow. Then again, there are people who can't get it morally at all, like psychopaths. Now, their existence doesn't challenge anything. Beyond that, the fact that in ethics it's a complicated and complex skill, which you might lose, which nobody can exactly tell you how to operate, they can just operate it in front of you, so you catch on, seems to me non-threatening from a sceptical point of view.
So how do you get good at being a moral agent?
Well, you get good at being a moral agent by being the way that children are when they're in the family. They act and they get told off, and they sometimes get told why they shouldn't be acting in this way, and they get praised. We're all born with all sorts of emotional capacities, and those capacities get trained by our parents, at least we hope they do. They get adjusted. So by the time you come out, before you're 10 anyway, it's pretty much fixed, but you can still improve it.
Every now and then the government sets up a committee on something like pornography or the use of in vitro fertilisation, and quite often philosophers are thrown into these committees. Now, on your view, what role could they possibly have?
Well, the role that they have wouldn't be based on this, that they know the true principles. That doesn't seem a very plausible suggestion that philosophers somehow have got hold of the true principles. I think that if philosophers are put on these panels, it's because of the people they are, not because of the subject they teach. They need to be people who have a wide understanding, who have the kind of subtlety of judgment that enables you to operate in these very difficult areas, who recognise the importance of opposing points of view, and so on. I don't see that being a philosopher equips you with those qualities.
Imagine two people are disagreeing about a particular moral action. One says it's okay, the other one says it's absolutely intolerable. How can you explain that kind of disagreement?
Well, that's an overall disagreement about the action, but I think the hard disagreement to explain would be disagreement about the relevance of some particular feature. If you think it's outrageous and I think it's absolutely proper and required, then it seems to me there's quite a lot to unravel before we get to a brute disagreement of some sort. There has to be something underneath that explains those differences in overall judgment. But now let's look underneath and we're going to find some feature that you think counts against and I think counts in favour, or something like that. Now then the question is, can we make any progress on this front, or are we just reduced to looking at it? Now I think that you can make progress. The aesthetic analogy tells us that people can debate and perhaps change each other's views. You need the appropriate willingness to change your own. In addition to that, there's sort of triangulation. You can say, how would it have been if this feature had been a bit different? Or consider this other action that is relevantly similar in lots of respects, but different in some. Would you say the same about that one? The particularists recognise that question has to be addressed and answered. And they think that answering it can lead you to reconsider. Asking similar questions to somebody else can lead them to reconsider, and thus we can at least make some progress.
Now, I know just because something's true, it doesn't mean that everybody ought to know that it's true, because that could be damaging to the moral behaviour of the world. Is particularism a bit like this?
It certainly isn't true that everyone ought to believe it, because that would be a principle. In fact, there's no philosophical view that everyone ought to believe. It's among the things that I think everybody should at least consider. But that's as much as I would claim.
Jonathan Dansley, thank you very much.
Right, thank you. It was fun.
There's now a Philosophy Bites book published by Oxford University Press. For more information, go to www.philosophybites.com.
For more information about the Institute, go to www.philosophy.sas.ac.uk.